Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, good,
good
morning.
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 Morning, Howard. It's Michelle.
Hey, Michelle. How you doing?
How are you?
Howard, thank you for that little reminder you sent last night.
Oh, yeah. Well, who knows when we'll hear from her.
Right.
You know, they're always hot to trot on responses, and then when you respond, they sort of fall into a black hole.
Yes, they do. But I guess she's just not getting cooperation, though.
That could be. Well, we'll see.
Hi,
if she...
Howard,
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Doing great, thank you. We all got to be good. It's a nice day, right?
That's right,
in contrast to what we've had.
That's right, and it's Happy Pi Day.
3.14.
Oh my goodness, it certainly is Pi Day.
Yeah, we're actually having pies in our office today.
I love that.
Good, we might do that.
I'm coming down, Howard.
All right, you know, you're always welcome, man.
I know. That's very fun.
Michelle, take good care of you, right, Michelle?
Oh, yeah. We've got lots of pie today. Little competition.
I love that idea.
Yep. Fortunately, I didn't make anything, because if I made anything, no one would eat it, including me.
You know, that's what you say.
No, that's what I say and mean. All right, so we got 2 minutes to go. Grab your coffee, juice, whatever.
Hello?
Hey, Mikey, how are you?
Good. How you doing, Hal?
Good. Got 1 minute left.
Paul Miller.
Okay, it is 9:02. As you know, we always start at 9:02. Michelle, can you mute these lines? Okay, good morning, everybody. As usual, lots to report on. I'm going to start first with the fact that last Friday, the Department of Labor Licensing and Regulation, if you don't know, published some additional materials having to do with the Maryland Safe and Sick Leave Act. So they published an updated version of Frequently Asked Questions. They published a revised notice, and they published some sample policies. I'm going to comment on some of these this morning. I would invite you certainly to go on their website. It's easy to get on their website, easy to download these documents that I'm talking about. But I wanted to comment on some things that I think may be of interest to you. First, with regard to the updated frequently asked questions, these were updated as of March the 9th. And I think that there are a bunch of them. Not everyone is updated, so I'm just going to pick out ones that were updated and which I think are of interest to you out there. First, one of the questions is, why does the law say that it became effective on January 1, 2018, but your guidance says that it became effective on February the 11th? And the answer is, under their frequently asked questions, the Maryland Healthy Working Families Act was introduced during the 2017 session of the General Assembly. As drafted, the bill provided that the law became effective January 1, 2018. The General Assembly voted to pass the bill, but the governor vetoed it. When the General Assembly came back into session in January 2018, it voted to override the governor's veto. The law became effective 30 days after the General Assembly voted to override the veto. I know I've had questions from clients about this seeming discrepancy, and it's clear that you don't have to retroactively go back if you're doing an accrual as of January 1, 2018. Rather, you accrue as of February the 11th, the effective date of the particular statute. Another frequently asked question updated was, can an employer provide for different methods of accrual for different types of employees? The revised answer, yes. An employer could front-load leave to full-time employees, but provide that part-time employees earn leave on an accrual basis. The department recommends that such a policy be in writing, clearly communicated to employees, and applied consistently with regard to each type of employee. Another question, which is new, can an employer count paid holidays toward earned sick and safe leave? Does an employee accrue earned sick and safe leave while using PTO? Their answer, in general, if an employer's business does not operate on certain holidays and the employer provides paid time off for those holidays, the employer cannot, I repeat, cannot deduct those holiday hours from an employee's earned sick and safe leave. If an employer's business operates on holidays and employees can work or are expected to work on the holiday, the employer may deduct from the employee's leave accrual if the employee uses earned sick and safe leave rather than work on the holiday. Whether an employee accrues sick and safe leave while on paid leave off status depends on the employer's policy. The law does not require that an employee accrue sick and safe leave while using paid time off. So obviously, most of you as employers will not want to have employees accrue any kind of sick and safe leave while they are using paid time off. The next question that's revised is the question of what does regularly works less than 12 hours per week mean, and what happens in weeks where an employee works less than 12 hours? The revised answer, the law does not define regularly. While the word is not defined in the law, the commissioner suggests using the everyday meaning of the word, which is in quotes, normal or customary, close quotes. Thus, an employee who normally or customarily works less than 12 hours per week would not be covered by the law. If an employee normally or customarily works 12 or more hours per week, but the employee works less than 12 hours in an isolated week, those hours in the isolated week would still count toward the employee's sick and safe leave accrual. So I'm not sure that it gives you any real guidance other than use your common sense about the use of the word regularly. The next question, revised, or actually new, is how does an employer handle the accrual of earned sick and safe leave if the employer front-loads leave and the employee is not hired at the beginning of the designated benefit year? Many clients have asked me this. Generally, their answer is, if an employer's benefit year begins on January 1st and the employer front-loads earned sick and safe leave on that date, for an employee who is hired at any other date throughout the year, the employer will need to ensure that the employee earns sick and safe leave in an amount equal to or greater than the leave provided for under the Earned Sick and Safe Leave law until the beginning of the next benefit year. So practically, it seems to me, if you have a sick and safe leave policy where you are front-loading as of, let's say, January 1, and you hire an employee on April the 1st, you have two choices, it seems to me, under the law. One is to give that employee the full 40 hours of the leave to use for the balance of the year, even though the employee wasn't on board as of January the 1st. Or you could have that employee accrue under the schedule provided in the Act. That is, the employee who starts on April the 1st would accrue leave, obviously, at the rate of 1 hour for every 30 hours worked for the balance of the year, and then once January 1st of the next year comes, front load that employee with 40 hours. So you have two options under these frequently asked questions, it seems to me. Now, they also put out a revised notice. I'm not seeing anything that's really all that profound in the revised notice, although they have attached a translation of this notice in Spanish. So those of you who have any kind of volume of Hispanic employees may appreciate the fact that they have translated this notice into Spanish. Finally, with regard to this particular issue, they have attached, attachment A is the sample leave policies for employers awarding earned sick and safe leave at the beginning of the year. It's a two-page document. Again, I don't think there's anything profound in it. Although there are a few things that I would say if you have a situation where you're front-loading leave. There is a provision in here that states that the year commences on blank and ends on blank. So you probably want to say in your policy when your leave year begins and when it ends. Also, you want to make clear for those of you who have a front-loading policy that employees are not permitted to carry over unused leave at the end of the year, and that they will not be paid for any unused leave upon the termination of their employment. Also, that they would not be permitted to use leave during the first 106 calendar days of your or of their employment. For those who have an accrual policy, they have a sample attachment B, which is the accrual method of leave. One of the things that you'll want to pay attention to in this policy is the statement that an employee may carry over any may carry over any earned but unused sick and safe leave up to 40 hours, but an employee may not accrue more than 64 hours of sick and safe leave at any time. So again, I invite you to go on their website. It's easy to find. All you have to do is Google Maryland Department of Labor Licensing and Regulation, and it'll take you right to the website. And right on their homepage is guidance that you can get into for the safe and sick leave law. Okay, enough about that. Last week on March the 6th, the Labor Secretary Acosta rolled out a pilot program which the Department of Labor is going to use for 6 months. It's called the Payroll Audit Independent Determination Program under the acronym PAID, P-A-I-D, Payroll Audit Independent Determination Program. This is a pilot program that the DOL is going to use, and it's essentially a self-audit program under which employers can self-audit their wage and hour practices to ascertain whether they believe they have any liability, for instance, under misclassification of employees or non-payment or mispayment of overtime, or whether they have any off-the-clock kinds of liability. And the really the theme of this pilot program is for those employees who they find through the self-audit who have been non-paid or mispaid, they can go ahead and they can correct it without paying liquidated damages. They can report it to the DOL, and in good faith, the DOL will not impose any penalties or liquidated damages. There are many questions to be answered about this program, and I suspect that in the next, I would say, 3-4 weeks, the DOL will put out either some frequently asked questions, but its purpose is good in the sense that it will allow employers, at least under this pilot program, to audit, self-audit their payment practices in a way that may be less damaging than if an employee brought a complaint to the DOL or the DOL audited your particular practices. But there are open questions, and it doesn't necessarily mean that if you settle a federal cause of action under the Fair Labor Standards Act, then an employee would be precluded from bringing a state law action. So there are many questions, but many of you may have seen or heard of this program. That's what it's about, and we're just going to have to wait and see what this program really proves to be, whether it's useful to employers or whether in some respects it even increases the risk to an employer by sort of opening up a Pandora's box. So stay tuned, and I'll report back to you on that. I wanted to bring to your attention a case that was decided very recently, Fourth Circuit, which governs those of you who do business in Maryland. The case is called Cooper versus Smithfield Packing Company. Again, a Fourth Circuit case. In this case, which was decided last Monday, not this past Monday, but the Monday before, an employee or an ex-employee named Cooper sued Smithfield Packing on a sexual harassment case. And essentially what happened was the employee Cooper alleged that his so-called supervisor had sexually harassed her for a long period of time. She reported it to the HR department. The HR department immediately began conducting an investigation, but one day after she reported it, she resigned, certainly claiming a constructive discharge in the case. In the case, she filed before the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. She then got, obviously, a right to sued in federal court. Federal court dismissed the case on summary judgment, and it went up to the Fourth Circuit. And the Fourth Circuit affirm the dismissal of the case. And there are a couple noteworthy things about this in the decision. So, as the Fourth Circuit says in its decision, this clearly is not a case in which Smithfield adopted a, quotes, see no evil, hear no evil strategy, close quotes. They went on to say, further, the record evidence showed that Smithfield first learned of the supervisor's harassment only days before the employee voluntarily resigned. They pointed out that in the company's favor, that they regularly conducted on an annual basis training of all of their employees. They had an anonymous tip line by which complaints could be reported. And that the person who was alleged to be her supervisor was not really a supervisor, but really more of a lead worker. The reason that's important is under the law, if an employee makes a claim of harassment, and it's only harassment which was allegedly conducted by a co-employee as opposed to a statutory supervisor, the standard under which liability can be imposed is a negligence standard. That is, whether the employer knew or should have known of the particular acts in question. Here, they determined clearly that the alleged supervisor was not a supervisor, that immediately upon reporting the act of harassment or acts of harassment, the company undertook a clear investigation and did what any responsible employer would do. And there's an interesting quote in the case, and I'll read it to you. It says, taking the evidence in the light most favorable to Cooper, who was the plaintiff, a finding of negligence on this record would be tantamount to requiring Smithfield to exercise an all-seeing omnipresence over the workplace, which this court will not do. So it's sort of a lesson. It's a good roadmap for those of you in the sort of harassment field, in that immediately upon getting the report of harassment, the company reacted, began its investigation, and before it even could finish the investigation, the employee resigned. And that's just a lesson that indicates that an employer has to be given a fair opportunity when the allegation is against a co-employee, as opposed to a statutory supervisor, to investigate the case. And it also harkens back to a 1998 Supreme Court case called Onkel versus Sundower Offshore Services, which is that Title VII is not a general civility code that prohibits all verbal or physical harassment in the workplace. And along those lines, this was just yesterday at a SHRM conference in Washington, D.C. So there is a report in Law 360 today, which I get on a daily basis. And I'll just read certain portions to you because it's, I think, relevant in today's day and age. It says, the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission hasn't seen a surge in sexual harassment complaints since the start of the Me Too movement, but more workers have been threatening to sue, acting EEOC Commissioner Victoria Lipnick said Tuesday at a Society for Human Resource Management conference in Washington, D.C. She went on to say, people may not be yet going to the EEOC, and in fact, we have not seen a huge surge in charges being filed with the EEOC, but what I am hearing is particularly from insurance carriers, they're seeing a lot more demand letters. In essence, what that's saying is that there are demand letters being sent to employers, hopefully not you, from attorneys on behalf of putative plaintiffs. And of course, a demand letter would be a precursor to an employee filing a charge with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and then subsequently a lawsuit. So as this article says, Lipnick joked that she and many of the HR representatives in the audience date their lives between pre-October 5 and post-October 5, a reference to the publication date of the New York Times blockbuster report into alleged sexual harassment by prominent movie producer Harvey Weinstein. And finally, in this article, reporting on what Ms. Lipnick said, and it's not often that I agree all the time with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, but she did say something that I think, with which I agree. She said, "It's critical that management take the lead on addressing sexual harassment." And I quote, "If the leadership of the organization is not invested in making sure that the culture of their organization is one that does not tolerate harassing behavior and doesn't let these kinds of things happen, then you can do training every 6 months and it's not going to make much of a difference," Lipnick said. And I agree with that. I think that it's one thing to do training, it's one thing to publish your policy, but there really does need to be investment in the culture by your top leadership, which is why I always advise clients not only to engage in training, but on an annual basis to have the CEO or president of your enterprise republish your workplace harassment policy as a critical and important policy of the company. Not only do I believe that it's the right thing to do, but I think it serves you well should you get these demand letters or should you get a charge of workplace harassment by any employee or ex-employee. And it's important to be able to demonstrate your commitment through top management that it's not tolerated, and in fact, on an annual basis, you republish these policies and make it known to employees that you have a culture of zero tolerance at your workplace. Okay, those are the developments for the day. Michelle, can you take this off of mute? Michelle?
We are pleased to have served you, our customers, for 30 years.
Any questions or comments that I can help out with? Somebody's got background.
Every week, dealers can jump online at www.
Thank you.
Howard, what was the name again of that Department of Labor pilot program on self-audits? I didn't catch it. I know it was paid, but what was the name?
It's called the Payroll Audit Independent Determination Program, so hence the acronym PAID, P-A-I-D.
Okay.
And it's gotten some publicity, not a lot, but some publicity, and I'm just not sure whether it'll be successful or whether employers will take advantage of it, but it's an interesting concept.
It is. So the fact that you could get tripped up then by your state laws is kind of the horns of a dilemma.
It is, Anne, and, you know, it is one of the major questions yet to be answered regarding how this will interact with state laws. I'm not sure that they've completely thought it through at the higher levels of the Department of Labor.
So they might not be able to overcome state law claims at the
federal
level, right?
That's right. They may not be able to.
They may not have the legal basis to be able to do that. Yeah, but thank you. Very interesting. Thanks.
Sure. Any other questions? Okay, well, if not, the next telebrief is on the fourth Wednesday. I think it's the 28th. It may be that I have to pre-record that. I'm not sure. I have a management meeting that morning, but we'll send out a notice one way or another. There certainly will be a telebrief. The only question whether it'll be live Howard Kerman or recorded Howard Kerman. In any event, thanks for your participation, and as always, hopefully the next 2 weeks will be copacetic for you all in the employment field. Take care.
Thank you very much, Howard.
Thank you, Howard.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.